Through to the end. So I'm going to talk about another frustrated spin system, but a different one, one that's inspired by cesium copper chloride, of which this is some crystals. So this is work done with my student, Sidik Gamari, who's here, as well as my colleagues, Sung-Sik Lee and Eric Sorensen. So we study what seems like a very simple model. It's just the spin one-half Heisenberg model on a triangular lattice with strong coupling J along the chains and weaker coupling J prime between the chains. So this is the minimal model for cesium copper chloride, which also has a Zalashinsky-Mariah interaction that I'll discuss later. So the classical ground state is an incommensurate spiral state with a wave vector which varies linearly with J primed at small J primed, and which varies linearly away from pi, and which connects smoothly to the root 3 by root 3 structure at the isotropic point. And spin wave theory works perfectly fine as a starting approximation for J prime near the isotropic point. But the question is, what is the ground state for smaller J primed? And over the years, there's been a number of different, several different proposals. Actually, quite a few groups have proposed a spin liquid, including some numerical studies. So in some of this work, this is the type of phase diagram that's emerged where near J prime, near the isotropic point, one has this incommensurate spiral state. But at a fairly large value of J primed, and actually some of the numerics puts this as large as 0.9, there's evidence that, or at least it's interpreted as evidence that it goes into a 2D spin liquid, and some of the numerics also suggest that there's another transition or crossover around 0.5 or 0.6 into what they interpret as a 1D spin liquid, even though one has this finite coupling J prime between the chains. And just for reference, cesium copper chloride sits about here at coupling 0.36, but it does have a Zalashinsky-Mariah interaction, which is relevant. So this model actually isn't actually a good candidate for a 2D spin liquid. It doesn't have the macroscopic degeneracy like that you have on a Kagame or pyrochlor, and we haven't put any ring exchange into the model. So you would typically think that this model should order magnetically, and there are proposals for magnetic order. There's work by Svelik's group in a random phase approximation found that the incommensurate spiral could exist down to arbitrarily small J prime, but with an exponentially small incommensuration. And then there's a renormalization group by Sterk and Balentz, which actually is more accurate than the RPA and includes interactions not included in the RPA. And they find the surprising result of a collinear antiferromagnet selected at order J primed to the fourth for small J primed. And this is surprising because this is another classical state, but it has higher energy than the classical ground state. And, you know, often quantum fluctuations will select amongst degenerate ground states, but it's unusual to have quantum fluctuations actually select out one of your higher energy classical states. So it's a very interesting result. So there's some numerical evidence for the spiral existing, at least at somewhat intermediate J prime. This is a crowded transparency. I'm just focusing on this red box here. So this is unpublished work at this point, DMRG studies on fairly large systems, 64 sites by up to six chains. And they look at the spin-spin correlation functions and actually track the Q vector, so they actually measure the incommensuration. So here's the isotropic point, and then these data points are for J prime less than J. So they see the incommensuration fall off quickly with decreasing J primed. In fact, they fit it to this exponential form. But they see, and this is inset, it's just a blow up of the incommensuration, but they see a finite incommensuration at the smallest J prime studied, which is a half. And the reason they stop at a half is because at that point, the wavelength of your spiral is becoming comparable to the size of your system, or actually half of the size of your system. So they only stop because they can't get to larger systems. It's not that the Q vector is disappearing. So they take this as evidence for spiral order, at least down to 0.5, and there isn't any sign of it disappearing. Yeah. Is there a spin gap? Well, sir, it depends on how many ladders they have. So I guess in this, you know, so what the two ladder one has it, right, it has a spin gap. Yes, yeah. So they study 2, 4, and 6 ladders. Yes, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, actually, I think part of this slide actually has some information about the spin gap, too. So there's different work by Pardini and Singh, which uses a series expansion to directly try and compare the energies of the spiral and collinear state. So the blue data here is the spiral state with a variational wave vector. This is just a blow up of the last data point at point one here. Their J2 is J primed. And so they find that the spiral state always has lower energy, although they're very cautious in their interpretation, and they point out that it's actually very difficult to accurately compare the energy of two different states. So I should say these are results going to 10th order in the series expansion. But it's suggestive that the spiral is competitive in energy. So the key difference between the spiral state and the collinear antiferromagnet state is that as J prime goes towards zero, the Naël vector on these neighboring chains in the spiral state are aligned ferromagnetically, whereas in the collinear antiferromagnet, as you might guess by the name, they're aligned antiferromagnetically, and the prediction is that this is selected at order J prime to the fourth. On the other hand, if you look at numerical studies of small systems with open boundary conditions so as not to frustrate the spiral, one sees lots of correlations between these second neighbor chains that are large and start at quadratic order. So what I show here is the staggered interchain susceptibility. You apply a staggered field on one chain and look at the response on the other chain. And you see for the whole range of J prime between 0 and 1 and including negative values here, there's quadratic, cubic, quartic, et cetera, fluctuations. And the sign of this is always ferromagnetic. That's a little bit surprising in light of the RG, which starts with an initial condition of antiferromagnetism at order J prime to the fourth. So one question is, how do you reconcile these finite size studies with the RG? And I guess the really important question is, what happens to the system as you make it larger? So in order to address this question, we return to the RG, doing something very similar to Sterk and Balentz, except we stick to, it's a real space RG, and we stick to the spirit of the real space even more, that is starting at short distances at the lattice scale in order to match up to the numerics. And so I'm not going to give a lot of details, just some key points here. You make the continuum approximation along the chains, keeping the perpendicular direction y discrete, introducing the uniform and staggered magnetization. Then your chain Hamiltonian is described by the West-Semino model, perturbed by backscattering, which is, for the Heisenberg model starts off with negative. Then the interchain Hamiltonian is characterized in terms of these couplings gamma M and gamma twist, which start off at the lattice scale as 2J primed and J primed. And gamma twist in particular is what could stabilize a spiral state. Fluctuations can also induce new terms in the Hamiltonian. And for the purposes of this talk, the key one is this Naël second neighbor chain coupling, where the question is whether GN is ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. So from that continuum field theory, one can derive the RG equations. using the operator product expansion techniques. And here I've just shown some of the key RG equations and also just the key parts of them. So they're not complete, but they've got all the terms we need for this discussion. So the backscattering is marginal, starts off negative and flows to zero. Gamma twist is marginally relevant, so it's given a little bit of a boost with the initial backscattering here, also with gamma M. And also ferromagnetic GN helps gamma twist, whereas antiferromagnetic GN kills it off. GN is relevant. That's this one here. It grows exponentially or linearly in the real physical length of the system. It's also boosted a bit by backscattering. Gamma twist enters here in this way with a plus sign. That's telling you it's driving the system antiferromagnetic because of the sign. And then there's some higher order terms, one of which I pulled out here. These are irrelevant couplings. That's not important. I'll discuss this term more later. It's a J prime to the fourth term, and this is the initial condition, closely related to the initial condition of Balanz. So one thing, and it's also antiferromagnetic. So one thing, if you look at GN, there's only antiferromagnetism, and yet, you know, we saw in the finite size systems, there's all this ferromagnetism. Where is it? It's buried in this gamma twist squared term, which generates a term in the effective Hamiltonian of this form. So because of the derivatives, it comes in here with this total derivative, which is telling you that it changes sign. So if it's antiferromagnetic at long distances, it's ferromagnetic at short distances. So the physics here is that you have ferromagnetism at short distances, which is eroded by antiferromagnetism at long distances. And the RG equations differ from the Balanz RG by the inclusion of this term, because if you look at this for a uniform Nail field, then this just integrates to zero. So that means it doesn't contribute at Q equals zero, so you wouldn't have it if you did a gradient expansion. You don't expect it to order the system. If you leave that off, then you just have initial antiferromagnetism, and that kills off gamma twist, and so you get the collinear antiferromagnetic state right away. Let's keep it in, and eventually we'll come back to this point that it shouldn't order the system. So these RG equations, together with the initial conditions, determine the ultimate fate of the system. And here, I've shown I'm showing the flow diagram. Actually, as we vary for different initial conditions. But they're varied over a very narrow range. So here I've taken initial conditions where GN initially has a quadratic, cubic, and quartic term, all of which are ferromagnetic, because that's what the small system size numerical studies tell us. It starts off ferromagnetically at all orders. But if it's not ferromagnetic enough, then the system will flow to strong antiferromagnetism, and you get the collinear antiferromagnetic state. If it's too ferromagnetic, it flows to strong ferromagnetism in the presence of gamma twist, which itself describes a spiral state. And the most robust spiral state that one can get out of this RG formulation is one with an incommensuration that varies as J primed cubed at small J prime. So you can compare that to the classical case that varies linearly. But in fact, you only get this robust spiral if, in fact, ferromagnetism was selected at quadratic order. And if it's selected at any higher order, then you get a more tenuous spiral. And in the special case where GN neither favors ferromagnetism or antiferromagnetism, you recover the result of Selleck. So what are the initial conditions? Well, first you can recover the Sterik and Balanz result by taking, at least for small J primed and large enough length scales, you recover the result. If you take your initial conditions such that you have ferromagnetic, quadratic, cubic, and quartic terms that exactly compensate for the antiferromagnetism in this term. And the reason this comes in cubic and quartic orders, because you see gamma twist is picking up a quadratic piece here, since gamma m goes like j primed, and it picks up a cubic piece here. So if you take your initial conditions to be what we call exactly tuned, with this term providing a small antiferromagnetic imbalance, then you recover the Starker and Balentz results for sufficiently small J primed and sufficiently large length scales. And you know the reason why we expect those to be the right initial conditions is because this term gamma twist squared should not contribute at Q equals zero. Although you know it actually gives pretty subtle initial or complicated initial conditions for arbitrary backscattering. Turns out this fine tuning is very simple in the case of zero backscattering. For example, your quadratic term would just your initial condition would be minus j prime squared over 4. If you have non-zero backscattering as we have, this is your quadratic initial condition. Involves this incomplete gamma function. The cubic one is more complicated. And the fourth order one, because of this coupling between the equations with Gn here, can actually only be solved numerically. But nevertheless, you can determine numerically these initial conditions provide this small imbalance. And the RG flows, you see, if you start at 0.01, you flow to strong antiferromagnetism with only a very small gamma twist. But as you increase J primed, even with this antiferromagnetic imbalance, you flow to values with much larger gamma twist. And that's because gamma twist is growing through the quadratic and cubic orders where Gn isn't doing much. And so there's actually a crossover at J primed equals 0.3 J where you, gamma twist actually hits 1 first. And that's a signal that you should be in the spiral state. So if you just look at that a little bit more closely, here I've shown a flow line for a small value of J prime about 0.05. And if you look in more detail at Gn, you see it starts off quadratic and ferromagnetic, and it's actually ferromagnetic over this long distance of B, which is approximately 20 for this initial condition, divided by J prime squared. So over that whole distance, your system looks ferromagnetic, but then Gn changes sign and becomes antiferromagnetic. So that obviously is a great subtlety for the numerics. For example, at 0.3, it would say that your system looks ferromagnetic up to 200 lattice spacings, and it's only when you go beyond that that you see any signature of antiferromagnetism. Or another way to put this is even in the ordered state, if you assume you're in the collinear antiferromagnetic state, if you look at this Nail correlator for second neighbor chains, there's a J prime to the fourth term that's antiferromagnetic. That's from your ordered moment. But there's huge fluctuations of order J prime squared that not only, of course, they fall off with distance with a power law only, though. Not only are they big, but they're of the opposite sign of the order. And so that's a pretty unusual state, and you could see why numerics might, on small systems, might just interpret this as a spin liquid. The Dalla-Sinchi-Murray interaction is very relevant because it both enhances and is enhanced by ferromagnetism because of the way it enters the RG equations. It's a relevant coupling. You see it induces ferromagnetism directly in Gn. And that means that it's going to suppress the collinear antiferromagnet relative to the spiral state. And so you end up with a phase diagram like this where the collinear antiferromagnet is confined to a pretty small region here. And in fact, if you put in the numbers for any D that's greater than about 10 to the minus 0.5, or which is sort of an upper bound on the estimate, the collinear antiferromagnet doesn't survive. So it's a very delicate state. So this is what came out of the RG. Assuming that you have tuning, you can ask, how does this match up with the numerics on finite systems? Or you can turn that around and say, what initial conditions are compatible with the finite size system studies? And so this is looking again at this staggered interchain susceptibility. And here's DMRG and exact idealization done by Eric Sorensen. So this is just the raw data, the susceptibility as a function of length for a three-chain system for all sorts of different values of J prime, both positive and negative. And the first thing is the sign of this is it's all ferromagnetic. Okay, so after what I've said, that's maybe not surprising for small J prime, but it doesn't matter how, you know, if you're up at these large, you know, this is a 0.4. So keep in mind, if this one was going to turn, was going to be a collinear antiferromagnet, it would somehow have to come down and change sign. So there's absolutely no indication of anything turning over and changing sign here. So in the larger values, that's in agreement with the DMRG. So just crudely, you can see there's no sign of antiferromagnetism here. We can look at this data a little bit more closely because for small J prime, this interchange susceptibility is just proportional to this relevant coupling. This length dependence out in front comes from the scaling dimension of chi as well as the boost it gets from backscattering. So our RG tells us how this coupling and how backscattering should flow with length. And so what we do is we fit the susceptibility, basically this data down here for small j primed, both positive and negative values, we fit it to the RG flows going from 10 lattice spacings up to our maximum length, which is, typically a maximum of 30 lattice spacings or so, using the initial conditions at 10 lattice spacings as fitting parameters. So the idea here is that as you make your finite system bigger and bigger, that's equivalent to doing your real space RG over longer and longer length scales. And what we find is that the quadratic initial condition is slightly ferromagnetic, 5%. That's a small enough difference from tuning that I would say this is consistent with zero, which would be perfectly tuned within our finite size effects. Because, of course, having a finite size system and making it bigger is not exactly the same as doing RG on a big system. There are 1 over L finite size effects here. On the other hand, our cubic term is a bit larger. It's 25 to 30%, also ferromagnetic. That's because everything here is still increasing. That may be, it's maybe a little bit large to attribute to finite size effects, but one would really like to go to larger size systems to see this. And if one could go to larger size systems, one could finally maybe probe the fourth order term, which should really tell you about the ordering. So clearly one would, this is a problem, so I'd say at this point in time, there's no numerics that is unbiased, that is, a technique that isn't using a variational approach in that, that sees evidence for the collinear antiferromagnet. And on the other hand, the evidence for the spiral sort of ends at J prime equals 0.5 at the moment. So in conclusion, this real space RG approach allows one to study the interplay between the ferromagnetism and the antiferromagnetism. It connects directly to the numerics. And on the other hand, it also shows us how the large size and the extent of the ferromagnetism makes it very difficult to see this collinear antiferromagnetism in the numeric studies. This approach of the real space RG also allows you to study the transition or the competition between this collinear antiferromagnet and the spiral order, and we see that the DM interaction really suppresses the collinear order. And finally, I just make the point that if this collinear antiferromagnetic state is stable, then the staggered magnetization must change sign as the system size is increased. And there's no sign of this with open boundary conditions, and one might imagine, starting from somewhat larger values of J prime where the length scales aren't so prohibitive, and trying to push it down to see if you can really see evidence for the collinear order, I think. I guess there's one other point. I didn't really discuss the effect of backscattering, but since the initial condition depends on backscattering, that might be a handle one could have in the numerics to actually enhance the stability of the collinear antiferromagnet by varying that. Okay, thank you.
Can Thanks very much. Paper's open for questions.
I have the following question. In the beginning, when you discussed numerics, you mentioned they use cylindrical boundary conditions, right? We know that if we look at the on the conventional ladders, right, you have gapped, gapless. Then you put them on the periodic boundary condition in a transverse direction, so you get tube. And then, for instance, three-leg ladder becomes gap-full, so the critical properties changes. When you mentioned that you had them on the cylinder and you have open boundary condition, transverse direction, is there some problem there? Or did you check what happens if you use like tube versus open ladder, finite size?
So are you talking about our numerics for the staggered interchange susceptibility?
Yes.
So you
mentioned in the beginning, I remember.
There's other work by Steve White's group where they're measuring a different quantity, right? They're actually trying to measure the Q vector, and they apply periodic boundary conditions in the transverse to the chain direction, and they actually have complicated boundary conditions. They put a pinning field on one site on one end to get rid of the dimerization you often have, and then they use what they call smooth boundary conditions on the other end. And that's all to try and reduce the finite size effects. But you raise an important point. You know, when we talk about this three-chain susceptibility, actually, what we calculate is exact to cubic order. If you wanted it exact to fourth order, you'd have to actually do four chains. Because there is a contribution that comes in to fourth order, but again, it doesn't contribute at Q equals zero, so we don't expect it to order the system. So actually, the three chain should exactly capture all the physics of GN to fourth order if you're just interested in the ordering terms.
Just maybe one short to
and that's with open bound. Sorry, that's with open bound.
The understand correctly, but is it this system, for instance, if you go from small number of legs, right? Is it sensitive to the open or close, or like tube or open ladder?
So when I showed these numerics at the very beginning, these ones. Okay, so that's the interchange susceptibility. That's exact diagonalization. That's three chains, and you can see that with open boundary conditions, you see how we fit it to quadratic qubit. The lines that go through those data points are fit. So they're really good fits to the data, right? That's three chains. If you did four chains with periodic boundary conditions, so this is three with open. If you did four with periodic, the curves would have exactly the same quadratic and cubic term, and you'd notice that there's a little bit more ferromagnetism at fourth order, and we understand that term, and it's another one that doesn't contribute at Q equals zero.
Do
I understand what?
Diner order.
Yes.
Some of the early numerics.
Well, so the phase diagram, is, of course,
which was confused with the spin.
Yeah. So I don't think you should get dimer order in just the pure Heisenberg model. I mean, if you you could add a J2, a second neighbor coupling.
Well, in the pure Heisenberg world, you won't.
Yes. Yes. Well, actually, I think, so the phase diagram proposed by Balintz is that if you go near, the symmetry point where backscattering is zero, so that at J primed equals zero, you'd make a transition from Nail susceptibility to Dahmer susceptibility. So they have a phase boundary that actually stretches to smaller values of J2. We actually disagree with that. It's because I think the point is that when you turn on J2, J2 is actually favoring some kind of Nail order, whether it's spiral or collinear antiferromagnet. It may be weak, but it's favoring it, and it actually suppresses the dimerization. And one way to see that is if you look at the flow of backscattering, I didn't include this term, but there's GN itself alters the backscattering and makes it more negative. and GN starts off like J prime squared. So there's a J prime to the fourth term in backscattering that enhances it. So that's going to enhance Nail order. So I don't think, as long as you stay on the Heisenberg line, I think it's fine.
Okay, any further questions? Oh, yes.
In the phase diagram, you have a 2D spin liquid.
Right. And that was from some numeric work and also some theoretical work.
Is there any conjecture about the nature of the spin liquid?
What?
You're saying it's not there.
I would disagree with it. But, I guess Young Back Kim isn't here. I mean, there are some theorists that proposed a spin liquid I think he got that out of a large N expansion. So, it's an approximate technique that gave a spin liquid. The numerics that gives spin liquid, some of it's, exact idealization or DMRG onto lengths that went up to 18 with periodic boundary conditions. And it's basically that they saw a structure factor that was, basically featureless, in the perpendicular direction. So they interpret that as a spin liquid. I'd say you'd have to, there's things I didn't get to say. I mean, these orders are very subtle. The difference in energy between these two orders at small j primed is j prime to the six. That's the difference in energy between the spiral and collinear. They're both very subtle orders, and so I can see how numerics could easily just call that a spin liquid. Doesn't mean it is one, though.
In the organic compounds, some of them are somewhat described by an anisotropic, maybe described by an anisotropic Hubbard model, where at two lowest order you get a J and a J prime
right.
In your model, right?
Most of them are fairly isotropic, right? Or are there some that are quite anisotropic?
Well, experimentally, maybe J prime over J would be like 0.7 or something.
Okay.
Like. But experimentally, some compounds don't order. And I think it's been proposed that U is sufficiently small that you get ring exchange generated in the system.
Yeah, so my question. So that changes everything, right?
So that's my question. So what changes from the word go in your analysis when you put ring exchange?
What changes?
What changes initially in the RG description when you put ring exchange?
Okay, I haven't thought of it in terms of the RG. That's a good question. I'd have to think about that. Off the top of my head, I don't know exactly how the RG equations change, but ring exchanges is going to further frustrate, either of these orders, right? And they're both so delicate, anyways. I mean, one because the spiral has such a weak incommensuration, that's stabilizing its energy, and the collinear, I described it. So, I would not be surprised you'd get a spin liquid even as high as 0.7 if you had noticeable ring exchange. Is what? Ring exchange, I see.
But since with the ring, without coming back from the Hubbard, right? Because then you get,
The Hubbard model is always very small.
Well, if you're near, I assume, it's if you're near the transition is where you might get a spin liquid, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, the point is that when the ring exchange is larger, it seems to stabilize.
I see.
And then there is this question whether this is a personal transition or a decompiled transition. That's my understanding of
what's happening. I see. Okay. Sure. Yeah, that's seated.
Okay, well, actually quite a bit of discussion there, so I think we'll probably end it now. So thank you very much, Catherine.